From Illinois Soul, I'm Kennedy Vincent. Welcome to Dialogue, our weekly conversation about Black communities in Central Illinois. The University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign is a force in Champaign County, driving more than $1 billion for the local economy. But Black businesses are a small part of that. It's part of the job of Sean Garrick, the Vice Chancellor for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, to connect more Black and minority-owned businesses with the U of I. In late April, Garrick talked with our news director, Reginald Hardwick, about how the university is trying to connect better with Black communities.
Since Illinois Soul focuses on Black and immigrant communities, how is the U of I partnering with Black communities here in Champaign-Urbana?
That's a good question. I think there are a couple of things that we're doing. There's been renewed attention to public engagement and, you know, community engagement. And I believe Wanda Ward is leading that effort. And you may know of some of those activities. So that's one way in which we're trying to engage, you know, locally, the Urbana-Champaign area and its constituents and its residents. A big part of that is to make sure that they see the university as its resource, as its place, i.e., you know, you have folks from California who come to school here. You have folks from Hong Kong who come to school here, right? Similarly, we'd like folks from 10 blocks away to think of Urbana-Champaign as the place that they should go to school. So a big to really help accomplish that, you have to be in those spaces. You know, we have a significant international population. We recruit internationally. We have a very good reputation. There's attention put into that. Likewise, we have to make sure that we put similar attention into our own backyard, right? We also have Associate Chancellor Chris Spann, who's looking at his portfolio currently is K-12 initiatives. And why is that important? Again, you might think, well, with someone in the third grade, why are we speaking to third grade students and their parents? Well, you want them to, again, think of this as their place. Where are you going to go to college, right? Just having them ask and answer that question, regardless of where they go, right? Having them engage in that conversation means that you're increasing the chances that they do go to college, right? So that becomes part of their vocabulary. Well, what we would like to do is, again, once that becomes part of their vocabulary, what we'd like to do is to have them know why they should come here. What's all the great things going on here, right? You look at all the ag tech that's going on. I don't think there's a better place to be than the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. You look at what's going on in regards to quantum computing. I honestly don't think there's a better place to be. You look at something like the Humanities Research Institute and the impact that has nationally, I don't think there's a better place to be. The question is, how do we make sure that someone 2 blocks, 2 miles, 200 miles away from here know all of that, right? And particularly with the Black community, there's a history of folks not feeling included, folks feeling that they are the university approaches them when the university wants something, whatever that might be. So we're trying to really flip the dynamic and have it more community-centric, i.e., we are a resource to you. What might be of value to you? How can we collaborate together on the things that help strengthen you, your families, your community, right? And part of one thing we've been doing in that space for going on 4 years now is the Chancellor's Research Program, where I believe we've partnered with at least 15 different community organizations, where we bring together community-minded folks, faculty and staff from campus. And these are folks who have an idea that they believe can help address an equity issue, whether it's education, health, criminal justice. They believe that the university has something that it can bring to bear to improve their lives, their communities. And I think we've worked with at least 20, 25 different organizations. But in summary, it's about, again, making it community-centric as opposed to university-centric, where the community is something that we go to where we want to do something. Well, another thing that we're doing in that space is around business diversity. This is part of my portfolio. It turns out that the state has an aspirational goal for all universities to spend 30% of all expenditures within the diverse business community, right? So my office is leading that effort for the Urbana-Champaign campus. And it's a significant amount of money. I think our annual expenditures are, I think, $1.2 or $1.4 billion. Imagine 30% of that going to, you know, diverse businesses across the state. So we are working with the Black Chamber of Commerce. We're working with the Champaign Chamber and state leaders to figure out how can we be better partners to small businesses in terms of helping to facilitate more contracts for goods and services. But then also, are there things we can do on campus to help our own purchasers spend more with those businesses? So it could be streamlining payment processes, streamlining how people on campus use iBuy, which is our internal mechanism by which we select a vendor and so on.
If someone is listening to this and they're like, you know, I've tried for years, you know, to what is the first step, you know, that they can do to try to get some sort of vendorship or whatever with the university?
I would say one thing to do is to, again, reach out to local organizations like folks like the various chambers, right? Because they are more aware of initiatives that are already ongoing, okay? So that might be, say that's low-hanging fruit, you know? Another thing would be reach out directly to our office because, you know, we have programming specifically set up to increase the use of diverse businesses by the university, okay? I believe it was last April we had a Doing Business with Illinois event at the iHotel. Very good turnout from folks across the state where we really went over all of the process, all of the mechanisms by which business people, vendors, can actually engage with the university. We even had a fair of sorts where we paired up vendors with people who purchased goods and services that were, you know, well aligned with those vendors. You know, there's really it's a huge opportunity. You know, the impact is incredible, and what we're doing on campus right now is making more and more purchasers aware of, again, who the vendors are, what goods and services are available, and then making it very easy to make these purchases. I'll give you an example. One of the things that we heard from a couple of vendors maybe 2 or 3 years ago was that the university takes a long time to pay. So we buy their stuff and they don't get their check until, I don't know, 90 days later, 120 days later. I'm just guessing here. You can imagine if you're a small business and that was a fairly large order, you know, you're on the hook for that while the university goes through its official processes. One of the things that we're looking at is, are there ways if the dollar amount is underneath a certain value to really expedite the payment, right? Such that, because, you know, all of these rules are in place to make sure we comply with state law and regulations and so on. But there may be circumstances in which things can be accelerated such that the local small business is not on the hook while the big university complies with all of its rules and so on. So I would say, you know, again, reach out to either the Black Chamber, local Chamber of Commerce, and definitely also reach out to our office because we're trying to facilitate these connections as many as possible, as quickly as possible, because, again, I think the state goal is 30%. 30% of $1 billion is a lot of money. law of the money.
And correct me if I'm wrong, once you become a vendor or get into the iBuy system, you can do business with a number of entities here at the U of I. It isn't just the one that's requiring or asking for your business.
Exactly. And that's the goal, right? Because right now, even behind the scenes, something that a business person or vendor might not really see, we are doing a lot of the, let's say, the back housework to make it super easy for folks on campus to just click within iBuy, right? Because again, if you're buying Clorox wipes, right, and here's someone selling Clorox wipes. We buy a lot of Clorox wipes, on this campus. We use a lot of that. Imagine if it was simply as a matter of clicking this box versus that one. That is something that can translate into significant revenue to the business. And again, the goal isn't simply to enrich these businesses. The goal is really to deliver resources to the communities. We also had a small business program, for example, where we paired entrepreneurs together with graduate students and university faculty who can help them grow their business. You might have, let's say your business is doing $600K a year. You have some ideas to grow to, let's say, $5 million a year, but you need to more fully flesh it out, right? You may not have the resource to go to a place like Deloitte or McKinsey or one of these other consultancy firms, but with our small business program, you were able to come to us. We put you together with a team who could look at your proposal, look at your problem, and figure out how to get to where you'd like to be and what some of the issues might be. So we're trying to find as many ways as possible, again, to bring the breadth, the depth, the scope of this university to bear on the community.
I went to one of the Campus Community Compact meetings last summer, and I think you talked about it a little bit earlier. I remember people being very outspoken who were in the broader community, Black community, talking about, they only come when they want to do a survey for their international study or, and like you said, not feeling like they can come south of university.
Right.
And I know you talked about different initiatives to change that, but just for the people who may have been living here for decades, and they were very passionate because they felt like they have this world-class university that, and it just doesn't reach out until they want something. But what I'm hearing is that this administration hears that, you hear that, understand.
I think it's a couple of things. Number one, given the size of the institution, it will take a while for it to reach everywhere, right? But I think Chancellor Jones and his entire leadership team has been extremely clear of how important this is, right? You have to think about it through the lens of, again, it's a public university. This public university should be anchored in its community, right? And it's all of its community. So we have to find a way to engage everyone across all of our enterprise, right? So it's not simply about coming to university, although that's a huge part of it, coming, attend the university. It's also about making sure, things that are going on in the performing arts and athletics are available to all of its community, right? When you think about summer programs for kids and their families, right, you have to make sure it's available to all of the community. Things like the business diversity stuff and so on. Again, how do you make sure that you reach out to folks to say, we are the University of Illinois, right? This institution was created for the betterment of the state of Illinois, and you're part of all of that. So while I do understand that there's been lots of frustration, and the interesting thing is, the frustration doesn't just build instantly. It takes time to accumulate, right? So we shouldn't be so naive to think that we can undo all of it instantly as well. To really make significant change, it will take long-term sustained effort. And Chancellor Jones and his entire leadership team is very much committed to that.
Mm-hmm. That's IPM News and Public Affairs Director Reginald Hardwick talking with Sean Gehrig, the University of Illinois Vice Chancellor for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. The title of DEI itself has become politicized, especially after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that race cannot play a part in admitting students to colleges and universities. Coming up on Dialogue, Reginald Hardwick asks Gehrig about his job becoming a political target.
If you were to ask 10 people what DEI is, you'd probably get at least 7 different answers.
You're listening to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. We'll return in a moment. Welcome back to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. I'm Kennedy Vincent. This week, we're starting with Sean Gehrig, the Vice Chancellor for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. In our last segment, he talked about how Black and minority businesses can better connect with the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. In a little bit, he'll address the university's long, fraught relationship with Native Americans. But first, Gehrig's title itself has become public enemy number one in some Republican-led states.
Alabama is the latest state to outlaw DEI programs at public schools, universities, and other institutions. The governor, Kate Ivey, last week signed the sweeping measure into law. It prohibits any state funding for diversity programs.
Under the new Texas law, which came to life as Senate Bill 17, all DEI hiring and training offices at public colleges are closing.
More than 80 faculty members in 2 Texas public universities were fired for their previous jobs in diversity, equity, and inclusion departments.
Under Florida law and a new Board of Governors regulation, public universities in the state of Florida are no longer allowed to use funds to support DEI initiatives on campus. As a result, UCF eliminated its vice president for diversity, equity, and inclusion.
As we continued our dialogue with Gehrig, IPM News and Public Affairs Director Reginald Hardwick asked him about his journey into higher education and holding a title that's so politicized.
I am Vice Chancellor for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. It's in July, it will be 5 years. Prior to coming to the campus, I was at the University of Minnesota for 21 years, from summer fall of 1998 to summer of 2019. And my background is engineering. I'm a professor of mechanical engineering. And so I did that for quite a few years, rising through the ranks from assistant to associate with tenure and full professor and so on. And I believe it was somewhere around 2016, I joined the provost's office, the office of the provost at the University of Minnesota, to really look at things as faculty retention, faculty development, and so on. And then in fall or early spring of 2019, no, fall of 2018, I reached out to Chancellor Jones to invite him to speak at a conference I was organizing. And he ended up telling me about the opportunity here at Urbana-Champaign. And shortly thereafter, I applied.
Why is this position important, especially in May of 2024?
Absolutely. It's interesting. You have to think about it through a couple of lenses. One is you think about the university, think about the richness of the university, the expertise, the impact it has, right? The opportunities it provides to its students and their families and so on. Number two, you have to think about it from the fact that it is a land-grant institution. It's the premier land-grant institution in the state, right? The question is, how do we make sure that we are being good stewards of that resource, right? It's hard to imagine a institution like the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign being created today in our politically divided times, right? Imagine all the resources that would need to be set aside, the goodwill, the collaboration that would require to, from scratch, bring together something as great as this institution. I say all that because here we are with this fantastic university, okay, with a very diverse state. The question is, how do we make sure that we're bringing all of that excellence to bear on all members of our society, right? To me, that's what DEI is all about, DEI being diversity, equity, inclusion. I don't think it is something unto itself. It's a matter of, again, whether you think about it as the subject matter, something going on in a genomics laboratory or something going on at Krannert or something going on in athletics, right? How do we make sure that we extend fully a rich, robust invitation to all to come here to live, to work, to grow, to thrive?
We're following reaction to today's Supreme Court ruling that race-conscious admissions practices at Harvard and University of North Carolina, and therefore all schools, are unconstitutional. President Biden made a statement at the White House today.
Today, the court once again walked away from decades of precedent and make, as the dissent has made clear. The dissent states in today's decision, quote, rolls back decades of precedent and momentous progress, end of quote. I agree with that statement from the dissent.
Well, former Vice President and presidential hopeful Mike Pence said he was pleased by the decision and that the admissions process is...
What is your reaction to that? There are people who are actively politicizing DEI as a negative thing, and that's in your title.
Right, right. That's a question that's probably 2 weeks worth of answering, you know. So if we think about the affirmative action thing, that's just for a second. One thing that should be clear is on our campus, as probably on many, if not all, DEI, an office like ours, is not remotely involved with things like admissions, right? Who gets into the university? And that's a domain of the court ruling, right, around admissions and practices and policies and so on. Where DEI comes close is to all that is how do we attend to the community in which we welcome our students, right? How do we make sure, for example, that our low-income students, our first-generation students, our students from rural areas, right, folks who are traditionally underrepresented on campus, how do we make sure that they have all of, let's say, the sociocultural capital that would be necessary to come to a place like this and really thrive, right? Because, again, with students from the aforementioned groups, one of the big challenges, they don't have a lot of exposure to either people in their family or folks in their local community who have been to a campus like this. So in many ways, you know, it is such a strange experience. They don't know what it's like to, you know, to live in a dorm room, you know, to study, to go to class when there's no one there checking on you, right? All the sorts of things that, you know, I may have heard from my brother or sister or from an aunt or uncle or cousin who went to college, they don't have access to that, okay? So the role of our office, again, this is where it's somewhat, I don't want to say it doesn't, well, it doesn't pertain, but it's somewhat neighborly to the whole admissions thing, is, and that is, how do you welcome people to our campus? I think one of the things that we have to make sure we do as an industry, so to speak, as folks who do this work, is that we don't step back from doing that work of welcoming folks into our community and really helping equip them to thrive and so on. Regarding a lot of the criticism around DEI, I must admit I hate to even use the phrase DEI, and the reason why is because I sincerely believe if you were to ask 10 people what DEI is, you'd probably get at least 7 different answers. You know, so When folks ask me about what I do or what DEI is, I like to give a very, I'm going to say specific, but I like to give a definition such that we're sure that we're talking about the same thing, you know? And in the context of what I do or my role on campus, in many ways, DEI is about, again, how do we extend that invitation for all who would be here and could be here to come and thrive. But it's also about, you know, the pluralistic nature of a place like this, right? I.e., we have a variety of folks who come to our campus as students, as faculty, staff, whether we think about it in terms of gender or racial ethnicity or religious background. We also have, in terms of ability or disability, we have a significant international population. In my mind, all of those things help us create a more rich environment. The question is, yes, the environment is more rich, but are the interactions happening such that people benefit from the richness of the environment, right? Because if you're not doing that, then to a certain degree, it's performative at best, you know? So the big part of DEI there that I think is really important is the inclusion piece. How do we speak to everyone, and how do we, again, fully invite everyone to take advantage of this space? My background is in engineering, and I remember sometime over the past 10, 15 years, it became widely known that one of the best ways in which you can improve student outcomes in STEM or in engineering is to provide students with undergraduate research experiences, because that helps better connect them to the actual subject matter that they came here for, you know?
The University of Illinois is not renewing their contract with the school's first Associate Vice Chancellor for Native Affairs.
Jackie Rand is a citizen of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. She was appointed in 2021 to mend relationships with Native tribes pushed out of Central Illinois. Rand says the university never...
I know you can't talk about the specifics of that, but what is the commitment to Native Affairs at the U of I, especially in light of having a mascot that was so problematic for decades and hundreds of ancestral remains at the museum and such? You know, what is the commitment to Native cultures and affairs?
This is something Chancellor Jones and I are deeply committed to. And I would say what we're trying to do is to build relationships between the institution and our tribal partners, okay? Associate Vice Chancellor Rand has done some outstanding work. You may know about, for example, our Indigenous Pathways program, which the goal of which is to bring Native youth to campus every summer, again, to expose them to the university, such that when it's time for them to think about their own future, educationally or otherwise, they know that Illinois or a university should be part of that future, you know? We're in the second year of that program. We're recruiting for our second cohort right now. Just today, I met with the president of the American Bar Association. She's on campus at the invitation of the Center for Indigenous Science. Again, another instance of the campus, you know, putting its flag in the ground about what we are deeply committed to, you know. I think all of these things, again, the individuals are important, but it goes beyond the individuals. It's a deep relationship that we're trying to build between the institution and our tribal partners, again, for the betterment of the residents of the tribes who are removed.
What makes you most proud about being at the U of I, and where could we improve, especially in the realm of DEI?
It's interesting, you know. So I've always known about this university, you know, again, being an engineer, and in my particular brand or flavor of engineering, it's computational sciences. And I remember being in grad school, coming here to visit NCSA for a week-long seminar on how to program symmetric multiprocessing computers. At the time, a large number of processors was like 128 or 512. Now, of course, a large number is two orders of magnitude more than that. And NCSA and so on are still leading all of that. All that to say that, you know, all the greatness in STEM and computer science and computational sciences I've been familiar with for a very, very long time. What I wasn't familiar with, and I don't know if this is a direct answer to your question, but what I wasn't familiar with is how there's greatness sprinkled all throughout the campus. You know, it is not simply a STEM place. You know, you go into any department, whether it's, you know, psychology or the Center for Social Behavioral Sciences or, you know, fine and applied arts, you will find excellence at an unparalleled level, you know. And that, you know, even 5 years into it, that continues to impress me almost every day. Just the excellence, the commitment. I think there's a huge opportunity, and this pertains to DEI, but I think it probably more pertains to our land-grant mission, right? And this comes back to my mind, the whole affirmative action thing. You know, if we remember, affirmative action was meant to address something, okay? I may be wrong, but as I see it, it wasn't a solution unto itself. It was to help improve a situation. So let's suppose that, you know, for whatever reason, affirmative action is no longer in place. I think it's really important for us to consider what is the thing that affirmative action is trying to address, right? And put affirmative action entirely aside and ask ourselves the question, how can we bring the best of who we are and what we are to bear on educational disparities across the state and across the country?
That was IPM News and Public Affairs Director Reginald Hardwick talking with Sean Garrick, the University of Illinois' Vice Chancellor for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Up next, a video game about housing discrimination, where the only violence is the economics. And later, a Black Illinois woman who helps migrants face her own challenges with immigration. Welcome back to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Video games are bigger than movies and music combined. What can the games and vast industry that surrounds them teach us about economics, business, careers, and equity? David Brancaccio recently visited Detroit to learn about a video game about housing discrimination where the only violence is the economics.
We all know .com. Time to meet Dot, short for Dorothea, a character in a two-dimensional interactive video game out of Detroit called Dot's Home. In this dreamlike sequence, Dot has found a portal back in time.
She gets a hold of a magic key and travels through time to figure out that these choices that her family has made about their housing and opportunity, they are not easy.
Christina Rosales is a community activist and co-creator of the game, which is free on Steam or mobile platforms.
We wanted to tell a multi-generational story because when you think about housing disadvantage, it is cumulative. It has the ability to get worse and worse the worse your family is, and it has the opportunity to get exponentially better if you come from a place of privilege and wealth.
Dot and game players moving through the game with Dot get to hear about her grandparents' roots as sharecroppers in the South who moved to Detroit for better lives working in car factories. In search of a place to live, they run into discrimination and predatory practices. These require tough choices. The game has dialogue balloons like a comic book. We'll read out a few.
We want the house, but that Murphy fellow is just making us choose between a contract for deed or renting the place.
When banks refuse to lend to Black people, real estate companies might draw up something called a contract for deed. It's like rent to own. Under some circumstances, these can be dicey. Fail to pay on time even once, start over. Your equity vanishes.
Never mind the fact that it could take us between 5 and 50 years to pay the house off in the first place. I just wish we could get a loan.
The grandparents back in the late 1950s. Dot's parents come to their own crossroads in the early 1990s, whether to stay with bonds of community in the city or move out to, quote, nicer suburbs. Here are the choices for game players.
Somewhere where you and your kids can grow without worry.
A street where everybody knows your name.
A neighborhood where you shop at the supermarket without being stared at.
My name is Evan Narcis, and I'm part of the creative team on Dot's Home. I was a lead writer and kind of narrative designer. When you think about video games, I think the predominant image in most people's heads are like really violent first-person shooters, power fantasies. But video games, like movies, like books, like music, they can be a storytelling medium, and you can tell lots of different kinds of stories within that medium.
Among his many credits, Narcis has worked on 3 Spider-Man games.
You want to join us?
The idea of trying to talk about social issues and policy through a video game fascinated me. But then you get to, quite honestly, the blackness of it all. You know, like housing justice is something that impacts marginalized communities, black folks in particular. I felt deeply connected to that.
The game is a collaboration of multimedia storytellers and housing justice advocates called the Rise Home Stories Project. Funding is from philanthropies like the Ford Foundation. Its nonprofit social mission brings with it extra freedom.
Most like commercial and mainstream entertainments, including video games, you know, they have to modulate how they present a worldview by virtue of needing to turn a profit, right? We didn't have to think about that.
And this 2D game is being taken to a new 3D level. Anthony Baber was there.
We had kids in the audience. We're like, this is one of the best things I've ever seen in my life. And I think there's a level of importance where it comes to people of color being involved in the gaming industry or having a say in how we tell our stories.
Baber is director of community and culture at Detroit Action, an advocacy group that was part of the team that turned this video game into a fully fledged stage production where that 2D on-screen character Dot becomes Dot live action 3D.
That was David Brancaccio of the Marketplace Morning Report. A Northside Chicago woman was one of the first advocates to help migrants when they were sent to the police stations. She's an immigrant herself, living here on a religious visa. Due to the backlogs with federal office that oversees immigration, she and her husband are having a hard time finding a path to stay in the United States legally. Adriana Cardona Magigod of Chicago NPR station WBEZ has her story.
In the fall of 2022, on a cool Friday night, Luisette Kral was out and about on Devon Avenue on the sidewalk outside her small church. She was coordinating a free clothes pop-up store for newcomers who were staying at a nearby YMCA in Rogers Park. Migrants grabbed donated jeans, jackets, shoes, socks, underwear. Luisette helped them sort through items. Her husband, Ed Kral, played music and passed out hot chocolate and pizzas. That was my first introduction to Luisette. I followed her work with migrants ever since. She and her husband are both theologians from Curaçao, a Dutch Caribbean island. Luisette often jokes and quickly makes fun of her unique background.
Dutch is my first language. I am the first black Dutch that you meet, don't I? Ah, I know. Yo soy de la isla Curaçao.
She's easy to talk to, never afraid of approaching people on the streets, and quickly shifts between languages, English, Spanish, or Papiamento. Luisette's work with migrants is all as a volunteer. She's worked with refugees and other immigrants before, but this has become a big calling. She knows how tough it is for migrants to stay here legally because keeping a legal status in the U.S. has been tough for her too. She recalls when she and Ed started helping migrants in Rogers Park, where they also live.
We were standing on the supermarket parking, and some young girls asked us for Bibles. And we were handing out Bibles and Coca-Cola, and they asked us for Bibles. Usually they ask just for the Coca-Cola.
After that, the couple organized church dinners and hosted asylum seekers in their home. Then Luisette turned to housing.
I think I have helped over 100 people finding homes, and I do it by finding neighborhoods and parking my car somewhere and walk with them the streets. We walk half a day.
Last fall, a city-run shelter space was limited. Louisette partnered with the Institute of Cultural Affairs. The organization owns a high-rise in the uptown neighborhood, where some floors now house dozens of migrant families. The families pay the Institute an affordable rental fee for their space, and they share kitchens and showers. Migrants were excited showing off their space last fall. Julieta Pino, who lives in the shared space with her husband and kids, says she arrived in Chicago like most migrants, without clothes, with nothing.
Yo llegué aquí a Estados Unidos y llegué como todos inmigrantes. Yo llegué sin ropa, sin nada, y me dijeron de la iglesia. Fui un día.
Someone told her about Luisette's free store and the church. She went and felt welcomed. She says she's far away from her family, but now has a community. But the type of support that Luisette and her husband offer may be coming to an end. The Krauls have maxed out extending their religious visa. They've lived here for 12 years. Chicago has become a home to them, but they might have to leave this spring because, due to backlogs with immigration, applying for permanent residency will take years.
I just want to tell you how broken the system is. If I have to move, I can go.
Where will you go?
I have no idea.
Luisette highlights the irony of the situation, helping migrants get through challenges when she and her husband are navigating their own. Adriana Cardona Magigad, WBEC News.
The Illinois National Guard has a rich history that dates back more than 300 years. Across three centuries, the Guard has never been commanded by an African American or any person of color until now. Earlier this month, at a ceremony in a high school gymnasium outside Springfield, Major General Rodney Boyd became the 41st Adjutant General of the Illinois National Guard. General Boyd recently talked with Brian Mackey, the host of the 21st show. Here's a portion of that conversation.
Well, I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and not far from where I grew up is the General Jones Armory. It's an infantry, infantry unit. And I used to attend the Bud Billiken Day Parade, which is a predominantly African-American parade held right before the start of the school year. And I would always see the soldiers from that armory in their vehicles in this parade. And so that kind of inspired me to want to join the military, which I eventually joined after my freshman year of college. I joined the United States Marine Corps Reserve, where I served honorably for 6 years. And then I transferred to the Illinois National Guard.
When you started in the military, did you imagine doing this work long enough to earn a second star on your shoulder?
No. And if you actually average person, they would tell you that was never, you just don't dream of earning a star, period, let alone a second star. No, when I joined because I wanted to serve my country in some capacity. But as the years went on, I just enjoyed serving, and I just continued serving, and I just tried to take on the hard assignments along the way, and see how my career played out. And fortunately for me, it's played out very well.
Now, you've served from Desert Storm through the global war on terror and everything in between and around those. What has changed about military life in your time in the service?
Well, so we're all volunteer army. So the good news is that we still have some remarkable citizens that are raising their right hand and joining our ranks across all the services, not just the army. But what has changed is that we're having a tougher time getting those citizens to raise their right hand, and there's a number of reasons. Is at one point, the military, during my career, was very appealing. That was primarily during the Middle East conflict. But somewhere along the line, after the Middle East conflict ended, the interest in joining the military has declined as well.
And so you're finding it harder to recruit people into the life, is what you're saying. Yeah.
Yes, and it's just not the alone the National Guard. This is across the 50 states, three territories, and a district, along with the active duty side. Yes, it's a little tough to bring eligible candidates into our formation. Yes.
You know, much has been made of the fact that you're the first Black man in your role. I wonder if you can speak to what difference does it make in the work of your everyday soldier or airman to have someone of the same racial or cultural identity as their CO?
Well, first and foremost, for an individual to serve in this capacity, you have to have the credentials. And if you look at my credentials, they speak for themselves. But more importantly, it speaks to individuals that look like me that says, one day, if I take on a hard assignment as I have, and if I do the right things along the way as I have, there's actually an opportunity for me to actually serve in that capacity. They would be able to say that from this point going forward. Maybe not until I accepted his role, but certainly now they can look out and say, I have an opportunity.
If you want to hear the complete conversation of Major General Rodney Boyd, the new commander of the Illinois National Guard and the first Black person to hold that post, go to the website of the 21st Show. That's 21stshow.org. And that wraps up this week's conversation. Dialogue's executive producers are Nidhi Shastri and myself, Kennedy Vincent. Contributing producers include our news and public affairs director, Reginald Hardwick. Dialogue's theme song is produced by Lamont Holden and production assistance by Steve Mork. Dialogue is an Illinois Soul production and a part of Illinois Soul and Illinois Public Media. Join us for our next dialogue every Saturday morning at 11 and Tuesday nights at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul FM 101.1 and WILL AM 580 Wednesdays at 8 p.m.